cheer for me. Because in here, I'm the star quarterback. Until they don't need you anymore, Taylor said. Then you'll be thrown out with the rest of the trash. Nichelle yanked Taylor's hair. Don't push your luck, cheerleader, Nichelle growled. I don't always stop when they tell me to. She let go of Taylor's hair and Taylor fell to the ground. Oh, they'll always need me. As long as there's mutants like you out there, they'll need me. Nichelle stood up. And our session isn't over yet. So just sit back and enjoy yourself. She smiled darkly. I know I will. Chapter 34 Purgatory. Taylor was still unconscious when she was taken by Gurney from the holding room into a reinforced cell. She had no idea what time it was when she woke, or how long she'd been out. She was lying on her stomach on a vinyl mat that was too short for her. Her head was throbbing, and she groaned with pain. She couldn't see much. The only light in the room was a series of small red diodes blinking from the security cameras, and she was even more afraid than before. She thought of her home, her mother and father and brothers, and began crying. I want to go home, she said to herself. I know, a boy's voice said softly. She was startled by the voice. She tried to crawl away but couldn't. She couldn't move. Be still. I'm not going to hurt you. He gently touched her. She could feel his skin against hers, and she entered his mind. It was peaceful and soft and safe. Taylor looked up. Her eyes had adjusted some to the darkness, and she could see kneeling next to her was an African-American boy. He appeared to be about her age, though he was much larger than her. He was kneeling next to her and gently stroking her back. She could see the pale glow of his skin. He was one of them. Please don't hurt me, Taylor said. I won't hurt you, Taylor. I'm a friend. You know my name? Yes. Who are you? My name is Ian. You're one of them, she said. I am one of you, not them. Where are we? We're on level D. This is where they put the disobedient ones. We call it purgatory. Who's we? There are three of us who won't obey Hatch, four counting you. So what did you do? Or, I should ask, what didn't you do? Hatch wanted me to cause an accident at the motorcycle show. I could have killed the rider. That's one of Hatch's tricks. Tricks? First, he tries to buy you. He makes you feel obligated so he can manipulate you by guilt. If you're stronger than that, he tries to get you to do something wrong, something small at first, then he increases it. Once you cross the line, he has you. He will hold it over you forever, and he keeps upping the ante. You're lucky you're down here. Because if you were still up there, you'd be a murderer. My sister Tara's not a murderer. Yes, she is. Tara, Brian, Zeus, Quentin, Grace, Kylie, Nichelle, Tanner, they've all sold out. That's why they're up there and we're down here. She's my sister. She's your twin, Ian said. She was younger than most of us when they started with her. She couldn't fully grasp what she was being asked to do until it was too late. Taylor tried to move, but the pain made her groan out. Just stay still. Nichelle's drained the juice out of you. It takes a while to come back. He left her side, then returned with a cup of water. Have something to drink, it helps. Ian guided the cup to Taylor's lips. She drank thirstily. When she had finished drinking, she asked, Did they do this to you? Yes, many times. But not as bad. I think they mostly keep me here because my powers aren't as aggressive, so I'm not as valuable to them. That and because I'm blind.
You're blind?
My eyes are. I am not. I don't understand. I can see, just not with my eyes. I see the same way sharks and electric eels see, through electrolocation. Instead of using light waves to see, I use electric waves. Taylor remembered learning about that in biology. Electrolocation has its advantages, like it doesn't matter if it's day or night, and I can see through solid objects. You can too, of course, as long as the object permits light waves to pass through them, like glass or ice. But most solids don't. I can see through anything electrons can pass through.
You can see outside these walls?
I can see outside the school. Unless Nichelle's around, then I'm blind.
Can you see me?
Yes. You look just like Tara. Ian sat back on his haunches. I have no way of comparing my sight to yours, since I've never seen through my eyes. But I have a pretty good idea of the difference between your sight and mine. I can also see glows, and I can see how power is used.
Like Hatch's glasses, Taylor said.
Ian nodded. Here. They studied me to learn how to make them. You know this place is a laboratory. They're constantly doing experiments.
Nichelle said they're going to dissect me.
A dead glow does them no good. She just knows how to frighten you. It's what she's good at.
How long have you been here?
3 years.
Taylor began to cry. I can't do it.
You will. You're stronger than you think you are. Taylor buried her head in her hands. I want to introduce you to the others.
There are others here?
Like I said, there are three of us. In spite of the pain, Taylor lifted her head and looked around. To her surprise, there were two other girls. One was Chinese. The other was a blonde with eyes blue enough that Taylor could see them in the room's lighting. Both of them were glowing.
That's McKenna, Ian said.
The Chinese girl nodded.
Hi.
Hi, Taylor said. And that's Abigail, Ian said.
Hello,
Taylor said. Abigail knelt down next to her.
Hi, Taylor. I'm going to touch you,
she said softly.
It won't hurt, I promise.
Abigail gently pressed her hand against Taylor's back, and Taylor felt a light wave pass through her body, taking with it all her pain and fear. Taylor exhaled with relief.
What are you doing to me?
I'm taking away your pain for a moment.
You're healing me?
Abigail shook her head.
No, I can't do that. I can only take away pain while I'm touching you, but when I stop, it'll come back.
It feels so good right now.
I'll do it for as long as I can, she said kindly.
It takes effort, but maybe I can hold out long enough for you to fall asleep.
Thank you, Abigail.
You can call me Abby.
Thank you, Abby.
You're welcome.
Now, try to get to sleep.
Taylor closed her eyes and buried her head in her arms. Before she fell asleep, she said,
I love you, Abby.
Abigail smiled.
I love you too.
Chapter 35. Breaking into Prison. We arrived in Pasadena a little after noon. I was asleep in the back seat of the Camaro, lying across Austin. I woke when we stopped for gas and to change drivers. Wade's eyes were bloodshot, and he looked like he was about to pass out. He stumbled into the gas station to use the bathroom.
Where are we?
I asked Jack.
We're in Pasadena, he said.
I need the school's address.
I've got it.
I handed Jack the brochure, then got out of the car and stretched. The California air was moist and warm, and in spite of my worries, it felt good. I looked in the back window and saw that Austin was still snoring, so I went inside the gas station. I got 2 bottles of strawberry-flavored milk and a box of donuts. I knew Austin would be hungry when he awoke. By the time I returned to the car, Wade had climbed in the back and had already fallen asleep. I sat in the front.
Wade was pretty tired, I said to Jack.
Yeah, he was. He would have been here sooner, but he stopped in Lancaster and slept for 4 hours.
Jack started the car.
You ready?
I was blinking pretty hard.
No.
Probably never will be. Let's go. Jack smiled.
Nice.
Pasadena was lush and green with palm trees everywhere. I was 8 when my mother and I moved from California, and I hadn't been back since.
The city seemed foreign to me.
"Take Colorado Boulevard to South Allen," I said. "Then turn right." Jack followed my directions, and in a few minutes we were on Allen Avenue.
"That's the place," I said. "It looks just like the picture. Except for the prison fence."
Jack parked the car at a gas station about a half block from the school.
"Wait, wake up," he said.
"Who? We're here."
Austin woke as well and started searching for his glasses.
He had fallen asleep wearing them, and I had picked them up off the car floor.
"Here you go," I said, handing them to him.
"Where are we?"
he asked.
"The school," I said.
Austin looked out at the building.
"That's a school?"
"Looks more like a prison than a school," Wade said groggily.
"How are we going to get inside?"
Austin asked.
"The fence is at least 12 feet high and there's barbed wire."
"And the entrance is guarded," Wade added.
"Getting in is not going to be easy," Austin said.
I think he meant possible instead of easy.
Jack shook his head.
"He's right, man. What are you going to do?"
I looked out at the building for a few more moments. Then I sighed.
"Well, it's not your problem. You got us here." I reached into my pocket and took out the rest of the money. "Here's the rest."
Jack took it without counting.
"Thanks. Good luck."
"Come on, Austin," I said. As we were climbing out of the car, Jack said,
"Look."
I turned back toward the building. A white food service truck was passing through the gate.
"Get back inside, I have an idea."
We climbed back in and Jack started up the Camaro.
"What's your idea?" I asked.
He put on his sunglasses, then pulled out into the street.
"We're gonna borrow that van."
"Borrow?" Austin said.
"This is life and death, right?"
Jack asked.
"Absolutely," I replied.
We followed the van at a distance for about 6 miles until it pulled into a parking lot, where there was a fleet of identical vans. Two men climbed out of the van and walked to the building. As soon as the men were out of sight, Jack parked a couple stalls from the van.
"Wait, follow us in the car."
He looked at Austin and me.
"Let's go."
Jack, Austin, and I ran, slightly stooped, to the van. I figured we'd have to break the window to get in, but the van was unlocked, and we quickly climbed in. Jack checked on top of the visor, then in the ashtray for a spare key, but didn't find one. He pulled out a pocket knife, reached under the dash, and began sorting through wires. It took only a few minutes for him to hotwire the car.
"These old vans are easy picking," he said.
"Where'd you learn to do that?" I asked.
"I'm not a car thief, if you're wondering. My old man's a mechanic."
"I wasn't wondering," I said.
"Just impressed."
Jack drove out of the lot without drawing any attention. There was a CB radio mounted below the dashboard. Jack reached down and switched it on.
"Better keep it on," he said, "so we know when they discover the van's missing."
Austin was sitting in the back of the van with a bunch of metal trays stacked on a trolley. He lifted a lid.
"Hmm, chicken cordon bleu," he said.
"Don't steal food," I said.
"We just stole their van," Austin said. "I don't think they'll care about a few leftovers. Besides, it might be my last meal."
"He's got a point," Jack said.
"If they don't let us in the gate, we're screwed."
"What's our story?"
"What do you mean?" Jack said.
"I doubt they're expecting the food service people back so soon. We better have a story."
"I've got one,"
Austin said.
"Tell them we left a stack of trays with chicken cordon bleu in the kitchen, and it'll stink up the place if we don't get it back."
"Not bad," I said.
"I wonder if we'll need ID." I began looking around the van for paperwork or a badge, but didn't find anything.
"Nothing.
All we've got is the story."
"We can make it work," Jack said.
Austin said,
"Hey, look at these."
In a back compartment, there was a stack of white food service smocks and a sack of paper serving hats.
"Uniforms!"
Austin lifted the smocks and hats out of the drawer and handed one to Jack and me. Even the smallest smock looked like a dress on me, but I put it on anyway. We drove back to the gas station parking lot, where Wade hopped out of the Camaro. I climbed in back and Wade got into the front seat of the van.
"Put these on," Jack said, handing Wade a smock and hat.
"Sweet," Wade said.
We circled the block and headed for the school. "Ready for this?" Jack asked. "Yeah," I said from the back. Jack pulled into the driveway and slowly up to the guard shack. The guard, a stern, powerful-looking man in a navy blue security uniform, wore a gun at his hip. "What's up?" Jack looked surprisingly calm. "Sorry, we left a couple of trays of blue chicken in the kitchen." The guard squinted. "What?" "You know, blue chicken, delicious from the oven, but given an hour out of the refrigerator, it's gonna be stinking to high heaven. Stink up the kitchen, the dining area, the whole building. That blue chicken is stinky, woo! Diaper stinky." The guard looked at him for a moment, then grinned. "All right, go get your stinky chicken." "Thanks." The gate opened and we drove through. "Blue chicken?" Austin said. "It's chicken cordon bleu." "Whatever," Jack said. "It worked." He drove around the side of the building. We weren't exactly sure where to go, but there was only one open garage. In the back of it, there was a door guarded by a man with a gun. "Whoa," I said. "We've got another guard." "Worse," Austin said. "See that plate by the door? It's a magnetic switch. It's like my dad's office. You can't get anywhere without a card. No card, no entry. You better find something." Wade looked through the glove compartment. "Nothing," he said. "What do I do?" Jack asked. "Pull in?" "We have to now," I said, "or they'll know something's up." "Maybe we could offer the guy some food," Austin said. "Do you ever think of anything else?" Wade asked. "Wait," I said. "He might be onto something. We'll carry the trays in and ask the guy to open the door for us." Austin sneered at Wade. "Whatever we're doing," Jack said, "we better do it fast, 'cause we're here." Chapter 36. A New Glow. "Taylor." Taylor slowly rolled over, again feeling the pain in her body. Ian was kneeling next to her. "They're listening to us, so talk softly. Do you know about the last Electro Child?"
"What do you mean?"
"There were 17 of us. They found all but two, you and one other."
"Michael," she said.
"His name is Michael. Why?"
"There's a new glow outside the compound."
"What does he look like?"
"He's small, but the electricity around him is wild."
"Is he good or bad?"
"He's good."
Ian nodded.
"Let's hope he stays that way."
"What's he doing?"
"He's with three other teenagers. I think they're trying to find a way in."
"We need to warn him that Hatch knows he's coming. Can you warn him?"
Ian shook his head.
"No, I can only see."
Taylor covered her eyes.
"I failed him. I failed everyone."
"This isn't your fault, Taylor. You're a good person."
"How do you know that?"
"Because you're down here."
Chapter 37. Discovery.
Jack slowly pulled the van into the garage, put it in park, and killed the engine. The guard watched us intensely.
"Ready, Austin?" I asked.
"Yeah,"
he said, looking very unready.
I slid open the side door and stepped out. I grabbed one of the metal containers, then started toward the building's entrance. The guard's eyes were glued to me, and his hand hovered above his gun. When I was a couple of yards from him, he said,
"Stop."
I stopped.
"Yes, sir?"
"Where's your ID?" he asked.
I struggled to control my tics.
"Sorry, it's in my pocket. Would you mind getting the door for me?"
His expression didn't change.
"I need to see your ID."
"You recognize me, don't you? We talked last week."
"I wasn't here last week," he said.
I gulped.
"It must have been another guard. In those glasses, you all look alike. Your ID."
I sighed.
"Okay. Here, it's just in my pocket. Hold this for 1 second.
Jack opened his door and started to get out of the van.
"Is there a problem?"
The guard turned to him.
"Get back in the van. I need his ID and your ID."
"I'm getting it," I said. "Just give me a hand."
I pushed the tray toward the guard. He put his hands out, pushing back against the metal tray.
"I'm not going to..."
I surged. His mouth opened, but before he could make a sound, he dropped to the ground unconscious. I set the tray on the ground.
"Whoa!" Jack said.
"I'm glad you didn't hit us with that much juice." "It was only half," I said. "I'm getting more electric."
Austin jumped out of the van.
"Good job, dude!"
"Don't start high-fiving yet."
I took the lanyard hanging from the man's neck, then looked through his pockets for anything else we could use. I pulled out a thick plastic card.
"What's this?" "That's a magnetic key," Austin said.
I held up the lanyard.
"Then what's this?"
"Either a duplicate, or you need two different keys."
"Now what?" Jack asked.
"Tie him up in the van and get ready to roll. Austin and I will go find my mom and Taylor and bring them here."
"On it," Jack said. "Good luck, dude."
"Thanks for your help."
"I wasn't gonna let you have all the fun."
I took the magnetic key on the guard's lanyard and swiped it across the black pad. The red diode turned green, and the lock clicked.
"We're in."
I pushed open the door. Inside was a long, brightly lit corridor with surveillance cameras on both ends. Austin and I stepped inside.
"I've got the feeling we're being watched," Austin said.
"Just act cool," I said. "They'll just think we're food service guys." I kept walking.
"Where do you think she is?"
"Where does the dog hide the bone?" Austin asked.
"Just talk normal," I said.
"Find an elevator."
There was an elevator at the end of the hall. Inside, the buttons were 4, 3, 2, 1, G, L, and D.
"What's GL?" I asked.
"Ground level, or garden level if they're being fancy."
"Push D."
"What's D?"
"I have no idea, but it's below GL.
I pushed the button, but nothing happened.
Outside, I could hear footsteps coming down the hall.
"Look, it needs a key. Try yours."
I shoved it in the slot, but nothing happened. The footsteps got closer.
"Try the other key."
I switched keys, and the elevator door shut.
"That's it."
The elevator began moving down. It stopped just a few seconds later, and the door opened. I stuck my head out. We were in another corridor. The overhead lights must have been on dimmer switches, because they were barely illuminated. Also, there were thick metal doors spaced every 15 or 20 feet that looked a little like the door to the refrigerated room in the back of the grocery store where my mom worked. There were metal boxes outside each door with bright green diodes. The hall was empty, but there were security cameras mounted at each end of the hall. It was eerie being in such a large building and seeing no one.
"What's with all the security cameras?" Austin asked.
"Mr. Dahlstrom would be in heaven," I said. "We better hurry. I doubt the food service guys come down here." We crept down the hall to the first door. The doors were thick metal with dark, mirrored glass and horizontal slits, about 4 inches wide and a foot high. I looked through the window on the first door. It was dark inside, and I couldn't see anything or anyone. I went to the next door and looked inside. It was also dark, but I thought I could see a faint glow.
"I think there's someone in this one.
Is it your mom?"
"No.
Whoever it is, they're glowing."
"It could be Taylor," Austin said. "Try your keys."
I swiped both of them over the keypad, but nothing happened.
"It's not opening."
I looked up and down the hall, feeling more nervous by the second.
"I bet it's a magnetic lock," Austin said, looking it over.
"You might be able to counter it with your electricity." He crouched down to examine it, then nodded.
"The secondary magnetic coil should be about here. Let me see your hand. Don't shock me."
I held it out. He guided it to one side of the lock and backed away.
"Okay, now."
I pulsed. There was a slight crackle of electricity, but nothing happened.
"Give it more," he said.
"Okay." This time I pulsed with everything. The light in the hallway flickered, and there was a clicking sound followed by the hiss of escaping air.
"Are you done?"
Austin asked.
"Yeah."
Austin grabbed the door and pulled it open.
It worked.
"All right," I said. I stepped into the room. It was dark except for the dim light coming from the hallway. I looked around, waiting for my eyes to adjust.
"Michael," a voice said. "It's me."
There was a girl lying on the floor in the corner of the room. Even in the darkness, I knew who she was.
"Taylor," I said,
We found you.
Chapter 38. Michael's Induction.
Taylor was barely able to move. I knelt down on the floor next to her. What have they done to you? She started crying.
I'm so sorry I'd led them to you.
I put my hand on her shoulder. It's gonna be okay, Taylor. We're gonna get you out of here. Have you seen my mother?
No, but they told me they have her.
Did they say where? Austin asked.
No.
Taylor, what kind of school is this?
It's not a school. It's a laboratory.
A laboratory? For what? Another voice came from the darkness. To learn how to make more of us. I spun around to see a young man standing on the other side of the cell. He looked about my age, but was a full 6 inches taller. He was African-American and glowing. Standing behind him were two teenage girls, one Chinese, the other a tall blonde, who were both glowing as well. I'm not surprised that I hadn't seen them, as they were in the opposite corner of the cell and I was only focused on Taylor.
I'm Ian, the boy said. I've been watching you and your friends since you arrived this morning.
From down here?
I see through electrolocation. I can see through the walls.
Like electric eels, Austin said. That's cool.
Why are you down here? I asked.
Around here, you either do what Hatch says, or you end up in the dungeon. The two girls walked toward us. The Chinese girl said,
I'm McKenna.
And I'm Abigail.
I'm Michael, I said.
Do you also have powers?
McKenna nodded.
I can make light and heat. Abigail can take away pain.
Electric nerve stimulation, Austin said. Very interesting. I turned back to Ian.
Do you know who else is down here?
I can see everyone in the building, he said.
Do you know if my mother is here? They kidnapped her.
How long ago did they take her?
Just a few days ago.
Ian shook his head. The only female prisoners are on the next floor up, and they've been here for more than a year.
My heart fell.
Ian suddenly looked up toward the corner of the room.
Oh no, he said.
The two guys you came here with are being taken away by the guards. He turned back toward me.
How did you get in here, in this room?
Michael demagnetized the door, Austin said.
With his electricity!
Ian shook his head.
That's impossible. The locks aren't magnetic.
The sliding bolts are made of resin and work pneumatically. Everyone here has electrical gifts, so they prepared for that.
Ian looked back up.
They're coming.
Who's coming? I said.
Ian didn't answer. He grabbed the girls and stepped away from the door back to the corner of the room.
If I didn't open the door, I asked, then who did?
A voice boomed from an unseen speaker.
That would be me, Michael. We've been expecting you. Welcome to Elgen Academy.
There was suddenly a loud screech in my head and I felt dizzy, just as I had in the parking lot when my mother was taken. I fell against the wall, covering my ears. Everyone in the room groaned except Austin, who looked around curiously at us.
What's happening?
It's Nichelle, Ian said.
What's a Nichelle? Austin asked.
The cell door opened. The man I had seen outside the pizza parlor was standing there next to the creepy girl.
Hello, Michael, the man said. I see the group has been reunited.
He stepped inside the room.
Shock 'em, Austin said.
I took a step forward, then the screeching dropped me to my knees. Everyone else screamed.
Hatch turned to Austin.
Austin, isn't it? I thought you were supposed to be smart.
He looked down at me.
What do you call yourself? The Electro Kids? The Electro Club?
The Electro Clan, Austin said.
Right. Hatch smiled darkly. You don't belong here, Austin. But here you are.
I belong wherever Michael is, Austin said.
Hatch smirked.
Loyalty. I like that. Even when it's misplaced, there's something endearing about it.
Unfortunately, this is where your relationship ends.
Michael, if you follow me, we'll let Austin stay here with the others.
Austin looked at me. I'm not leaving them, I said. An even higher-pitched screeching poured through my head, followed by an increasing tightness, as if a metal band had been put around my head and cinched up. It was the same thing I had felt when my mother was taken, as if life itself were being drawn out of me through a straw. Ah! I fell to the ground, grabbing my temples. Stop it! Taylor shouted. Leave him alone!
Mike knows how to stop it, Hatch said.
Okay! I shouted. I'll go!
Hatch nodded at Nichelle, and the sound and pain stopped. Come along, Mike, I'm a busy man.
I staggered to my feet. My name is Michael.
A glow by any other name is just as electric, but as you wish.
I looked over at Austin and Taylor. They both had fear in their eyes. I'll be back, I said. I staggered out, and the door automatically closed behind me. Halfway down the hall, Hatch turned to me and said, I sincerely hope you won't be back to that place. I belong with my friends.
Then the question is, will your friends still be there? And that is completely up to you.
The elevator door opened.
After you. Where are we going?
Hatch pushed a button on the elevator. I want to talk, but first, there are tests to be run.
Part 4 Chapter 39 Initial Findings. Later that afternoon, Hatch was in his office talking to Quentin when Dr. Parker knocked on his door.
Come in, he said gruffly.
She opened the door.
Good evening, Dr. Hatch. Quentin.
Quentin was just leaving, Hatch said. Quentin immediately stood. Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. He walked out of the office and Hatch motioned to the same chair Quentin had occupied.
Take a seat.
Before she could speak, Hatch asked, How's our boy?
I've never seen anyone like him.
Explain.
I've confirmed your initial findings. His L waves are extremely high. Except they've grown since your first encounter.
So he is becoming more powerful, Hatch said.
So it would appear. But even more curious is that he seems to handle electricity differently than the others.
Hatch slightly leaned forward.
What do you mean?
His electricity seems to be circulating within his body, either through his bone marrow or central nervous system, which may account for some rather surprising phenomena. I administered a mild shock to him to see how he'd respond, and his L waves actually increased by 1%. I was so intrigued by this result that I upped the power to nearly 500 joules. At that level, I thought he'd probably jump out of his seat. But instead, he just sat there. His body told a different story, however. His L waves spiked 50%, then dropped and maintained at an increased 17%, and held there until the end of our examination. He still might be elevated. Hatch leaned forward in his chair.
You're saying he can absorb electricity from other sources?
It would appear so.
Like Nichelle?
Except that Nichelle doesn't retain power. She's simply a conduit to its dissemination. They seems to capture it.
Hatch rubbed his chin in fascination.
How is hoarding all that electricity affecting his health?
If it's hurting him, it's not manifesting. He's perfectly healthy. With the exception of his Tourette's syndrome.
He has Tourette's?
Yes, that's why he has the facial tics.
I thought he was just anxious.
Hatch rubbed his palms together the way he always did when he was excited.
Could his Tourette's have something to do with why he's different than the other children?
I don't know. We don't even know enough about Tourette's to know what causes it. We know it's a neurological disorder, but not a whole lot more than that.
But it's possible.
It's possible.
I want this information kept in strictest confidentiality.
Of course. All research is confidential.
I don't even want your assistants to know. This is between you and me.
Very well.
If you'll cooperate. Mr. Vey could be the model of the Glows 2.0.
And if he won't?
Then we'll have to fix that.
How's his attitude?
He was quite defiant.
Of that I'm sure. But there's one thing I'm equally certain of.
What's that?
The boy loves his mother.
Chapter 40 A Talk
The Elgin guards all looked the same to me. They were all nearly the same height and build and wore the same uniform. A black beret, dark glasses, and black jumpsuits that appeared to have been made from a rubberized material. They all had communication radios hanging from their ears and jaws, and they carried an array of weapons on a utility belt. A knife, a canister of mace, two different types of revolvers, resin handcuffs, a smoke grenade, a concussion grenade, and a long wooden truncheon. I was sitting on the floor looking through a shelf of books when I heard the lock on my door slide. I looked up to see the door open.
"Sorry to disturb you, Mr. Vey," a guard said, "but Dr. Hatch is ready to meet with you."
I thought he sounded unusually polite for a prison guard.
Of course, prisoners aren't usually given a room with a plasma TV, surround sound audio, and Monet prints on the wall. My room seemed more like a luxury suite than a prison cell. But if there's no doorknob on the inside, you're still a prisoner.
"All right." I stood as the door opened fully. There was a second guard standing a few feet behind him in the hall. The second guard didn't say a word. I noticed that they both had their hands on their mace. I guessed they had been ordered to be pleasant.
"This way, sir," the guard said.
We took the elevator down one level to the second floor. They led me down a marble-floored corridor to the end of the hall and into a large reception area, where a secretary sat at a large wooden desk with several monitors. Directly behind her was a glass wall, partially obstructing another door. In front of the receptionist's desk was another guard sitting behind a tall, circular podium with a plexiglass shield. The receptionist, a thin woman about my mother's age and wearing narrow reading glasses, looked up as we entered.
"We have Michael Vey," the first guard said, though it was evident she was expecting us.
"I'll inform Dr. Hatch," she said. She pushed a button, then spoke into her phone. She nodded, then pushed a button beneath her desk. There was a loud buzz, and the door slid open. "Dr. Hatch would like you to go in." The second guard motioned for me to go first, so I walked ahead of them through the open door. I stepped inside while they stopped at the door's threshold. I was ticking like crazy. Hatch's office reminded me of the ones I had seen on the TV lawyer shows, with bronze statues and busts and cases of books I wondered if anyone ever read. Television screens took up an entire wall. Hatch was sitting at his desk. He wasn't wearing his sunglasses. Michelle sat in a chair at the side of the room. I didn't look at her. I couldn't stand her. Hatch motioned to a leather chair in front of his desk.
"Hello, Michael," he said. "Please, take a seat."
I walked up to the chair and sat down, looking around the office. On the wall behind Hatch was a picture of Dr. Hatch shaking hands with the President of the United States. He noticed that I was looking at the picture.
"It's not hard to get to the President," Hatch said. "If you have money."
"Where's my mother?" I asked.
His eyes narrowed into thin slits.
"To the point. I like that. After all, that's why you made this futile little trip, isn't it?"
"Where are you keeping my mother?"
"We'll get to that.
But first, there's something you need to understand. More important than where she is where you are, and who you are."
His voice dropped.
"Do you even know?"
"Of course I know who I am."
"Yes, I know you think you do, but you don't really know."
His gaze softened.
"Who are you?"
"You're a victim, Michael. A victim of your environment. You have been brainwashed, your thoughts contaminated by the human petri dish your mind has been cultured in. For instance, you've been told that all men are created equal, but anyone who isn't stupid or ignorant can see that that just isn't true. Some are rich, some are poor, some are smart, and some are fools. No, no one is born equal, especially you. You're not even equal to the other electric children. You handle electricity in a different way, and you seem to be getting more powerful. I compared your L waves from now to when I first met you in Idaho. They've risen. It's very impressive."
He leaned forward.
"Do you know what we do here, Michael?
Kill babies with your machine."
Hatch chuckled. "What an interesting take you have on this.
That's the one thing I've learned about working with youth. If you think you know what they're thinking, you're mistaken. He straightened his tie. You're right, you know. At least partially. It is about the machine. The MEI, we call it. The MEI may have been a failure as an imaging device, but it led to the discovery of something more important. Much more important. If you think about it, Michael, there's a marvelous fate to all this. Many of the world's greatest discoveries are results of accidents. The MEI was one of those happy accidents. We set out to take pictures of the human body, and instead, we improved the human body. We invented superhumans. We invented the electric children. We've spent the last dozen years tracking them down. There were 17 of you who survived. 17 very special children. Sadly, there are only 13 of you left. 4 of you died before the age of 7. Died of what? Cancer. No doubt attributable to the excessive electricity coursing through your cells. We can't be certain, of course, but there's a chance that unless we find a cure for your condition, that may be all of your fates. I sat back in my chair. I had never considered that what I had was a disease. But I digress. I was saying that we had found all the survivors except 2. You and Miss Ridley. Miss Ridley was adopted out at state, and you know how inefficient government bureaucracy is. Her records got lost in the process. And you? Well, we tracked you for a while, all throughout California. You don't know it, but we've been more a part of your life than you realize. If you look through your family picture album, say on that trip you took to Disneyland when you were 7, you're likely to find a picture of one of our agents in the background. Then, right after your father's death, your mother pulled a fast one and disappeared. We lost you. Actually, it's quite impressive how she eluded us, saying that you didn't even know you were being followed. So we set some traps, and hoped that you would someday come looking for us. And you did. Actually, it was Miss Ridley who did. But we never dreamed that we'd be so fortunate that she'd lead us to you. In this matter, fate was truly generous. Fate sucks, I thought. What do you want from us? Hatch stood and walked around to the front of his desk, leaning back against it. We're scientists, Michael. We want what all scientists want. Truth. The truth about you. The truth about how you do what you do. We want to know why you lived when so many others died. No matter what you call yourself, you're just a bunch of murderers, I said. So much anger in you, Michael, Hatch said coolly. But boys in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, should they? What do you mean? Don't play stupid, Michael. We know all about it. I looked at him blankly. About what? Are you telling me that you really don't know why you left California? The way he asked the question frightened me. We left because my mother was trying to protect me. Protect you from what? I couldn't answer. He walked closer to my chair. So you really don't know? Hatch rubbed his chin. I think deep inside you do. You must. No child, not even an 8-year-old, could forget something that traumatic. Your mother wasn't protecting you, Michael. She was protecting others from you. His eyes leveled on me in a piercing gaze. I was ticking like crazy, both blinking and gulping. Hatch leaned back against his desk. I knew your father. I knew him well. Maybe even better than you did. My chest constricted. Do you even know where your father worked? Hatch asked. He worked at a hospital, I blurted out angrily. Hatch just looked at me for a moment. Then the corners of his mouth rose in a subtle smile. Good. So your mother didn't hide everything from you. He did indeed work at a hospital. Your father was the head of radiology at Pasadena General. Hatch slightly leaned forward. He helped us test the MEI.
His words hit me like a bucket of ice water.
No, I shouted. He wouldn't do that. He was a good man.
Hatch nodded. You're right, he was a good man. He was a visionary.
And like me, he never intended to hurt anyone. He wanted to advance science and save lives. He wanted to make the world a better place.
Hatch's voice fell. Unfortunately, he never got that chance. Hatch exhaled slowly. I know what happened to your father, Michael.
Hatch turned around and lifted a folder from his desk, extracting from it a single paper.
I've been saving this for some time now, haven't I, Nichelle?
I'd forgotten that she was in the room.
Yes, sir, Nichelle said. Years.
Hatch held up a paper with a gold border around it.
Michael, have you ever seen a death certificate? I shook my head.
I didn't think so.
He turned the paper back around.
Let me read the important parts. State of California, County of Los Angeles. Carl T. Vey died at 7:56 p.m. in Los Angeles County on the 5th day of October, 2004. Cause of death? Cardiac arrest from an electric shock. He set down the paper. It's about time you owned up to the truth about your father's death.
His eyes turned dark. You stopped your father's heart.
At that moment, I had a flashback. I was sitting on my father's lap. My father was grasping his chest, his eyes wide and panicked. Then flashing red and blue lights illuminated our kitchen drapes, and sirens wailed in chorus with my mother crying. It was true. That's what my mother was hiding from me. I had killed my own father. Darkness filled my heart and mind. I was barely 8, I shouted. I didn't know how to control my electricity.
Hatch just stared at me. Isn't that interesting?
We wanted to save lives, so we created a machine that could do that. Like you, we didn't know better. Yet you condemn us.
His voice rose and he pointed at me.
How dare you call me or your father a murderer? You're no different than us, not one iota.
He walked behind his desk and sat down. He looked calmer and his voice was gentle again.
But you can atone for this, Michael. Just as we are trying to atone for our mistake.
We're trying to do the right thing.
Then why are you torturing Taylor?
The loud screech went through my head and I fell forward, grabbing my temples.
Ah!
Hatch spun around in a shell.
Stop it!
The pain stopped.
Get her out of here,
I said.
I can't do that, Hatch said. I don't fully trust you yet. You don't trust me?
You're still brainwashed from the outside world. Until you see clearly, I can only trust you to behave like a human.
I just want my mother.
Of course you do. Which, of course, is precisely why we took her. And whether you see her again depends entirely upon you. If you comply with my instructions, your mother will be set free. We'll fly her here to see you, joyful reunion, and all that. If not...
His expression fell.
If not, sadly, I cannot guarantee her safety, even if I wanted to. I looked at him quietly. What are your instructions?
Simple, really.
Let's call them demonstrations of loyalty.
What kind of demonstrations?
I trust you remember Clyde. You met him in the parking lot and you spoke with him in the jail, didn't you?
How did you know that?
Hatch smiled but didn't answer me.
Clyde is, or should I say was, what we call a GP. It's a nickname we give our human guinea pigs.
Guinea pigs? I suddenly understood why Clyde had reacted with such fear and hostility toward me.
GPs are inconsequential. The coffee grounds of humanity. They are America's untouchables. Criminals and losers, none of them worth the carbon their bodies are made of. So, from time to time, we use them for the advancement of our scientific pursuits.
I was horrified by what he was telling me.
Where do you get them? I asked.
From all over.
Sometimes we pull them off the streets or from homeless shelters. Sometimes we find them engaged in some kind of criminal activity,
In fact, we brought in two new ones just today. Would you like to meet them?
No, I said.
These, I think you will.
He pushed a button on his desk.
Bring GP 764 and 765 to my office immediately.
I looked at him incredulously.
You kidnap people and use them for experiments?
Well, the word people might be a bit strong, but the rest of what you said is accurate. He looked at me with a grim smile. We're doing them a favor, really. Out in society, they would only self-destruct. Most of them already had. This way, we preserve their lives a little longer, improve their standard of living, and give meaning to their pathetic existences. They are actually contributing to society, instead of just staining it. A moment later, one of the guards opened Hatch's door.
They're here, sir. Bring them in.
The guard signaled to someone outside the door, and two other guards brought in the shackled GPs. I couldn't believe what I saw. Jack and Wade. They looked terrified, especially Wade, who was trembling so hard his chains were rattling. They were both barefoot and dressed in day-glow orange jumpsuits. In addition to the shackles and chains on their legs and wrists, they had large plastic and stainless steel collars fastened around their necks. The collars had green flashing lights. The sight of them bound made me sick to my stomach. I'm sorry, I said to them, shaking my head. I'm so sorry. Jack and Wade just looked at me with fearful eyes. I didn't understand why they didn't say anything. I turned back to Hatch.
What are those things around their necks? I asked angrily.
Simple devices to ensure they don't decide to leave us, Hatch said. It's based on the invisible fence theory. He looked at me.
Are you familiar with that?
No. That's right, you had neither a dog nor a yard. Some dog owners put special electric shock collars on their pets that will administer a mild shock to their dog when it crosses an invisible boundary. It trains the dog to not leave the yard. These collars your associates are sporting operate on the same principle. If your friends leave this building, they will be shocked. The collar also monitors their vocal cords. If they attempt to shout or even speak, they will be shocked. But I'm afraid it's a bit more potent than that painful little wake-up call a dog gets. The charge these collars generate is quite a bit more lively, and will completely incapacitate them. His eyes moved back and forth between Jack and Wade. Maybe even kill them. You need to let them go, I said.
They're not part of this.
You're quite wrong about that, Michael.
The moment they chose to help you, they became a part of this.
His voice rose, and he looked at Jack and Wade with disdain. The moment they violated our academy, they became a part of this.
What are you going to do with them?
The same thing we do with all our GPs, whatever furthers our cause. He looked at the guard. Take them back to their cells.
You heard him, the guard said to Jack and Wade.
They turned and shuffled out of the room. How many prisoners do you have here? I asked.
Only a few dozen. Our Pasadena facility is quite small compared to the others. In fact, now that we have you and Miss Ridley, we'll be shutting down this facility and moving elsewhere. Some place where we have a little more flexibility.
Flexibility to do what?
He looked at me gravely.
We're scientists, Michael, and we have a vision. We've been trying to create the perfect glow, and we're getting close. You and Miss Ridley are very much a part of our plans. We've tested thousands of DNA samples. We've run thousands of blood tests, searching for the one link that all you survivors have in common. We've even been testing diets and nutritional supplements to gauge how eating affects your powers. We've discovered that with a non-sugar diet high in potassium, we can actually increase electrical flow. But you, Michael, are something else. Even without our help, you've been increasing your electrical capacity nearly 2% a day. At that rate, you'll be doubling in power just about every 2 months. In a year, you may be the most powerful glow of all. If your electricity doesn't kill you first.
What do you mean, kill me first?
Like I told you before, we've already lost 4 of you to cancer. That's why I sent you in for the checkup. You're going to need our help. The doctors out there can't help you. They've never seen anyone like you before.
There are no medical books on your condition. If you want to live to manhood, you had better stay close to us. His words filled me with even greater fear. What had they found in my exam? Was I really dying? It was too big to think about, and I pushed it from my mind. Why did you take my mother instead of me? Trust me, your mother would rather it had been her than you. Mothers are like that. Actually, we tried to take you both, but your chubby friend ruined that when he showed up with all those people around. We only had time to take one of you, and frankly, better her than you. But I'm the one with the power. Yes. But as you well know, power, undirected, is worthless. An engine without wheels. It's the old saying, isn't it? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Unless you happen to have your horse's mother locked away in a cage somewhere. Having collateral will make you much more malleable. Take your fellow Glow Tanner. He has an amazing power. He can bring down an airplane from the ground. The first time I told him to crash a 747, he refused. Until we let him see his little brother getting nearly electrocuted by one of your peers. It only took 10 minutes of his screams before he was quite eager to help out. You know how it goes, Michael. The first time you resist, the second time you relent, the third time you volunteer. It's that easy. Today I tell Tanner to bring down a commercial flight and he says, which plane? He looked into my eyes. We're creating an army, Michael. And you are a natural leader. You would make a very good general. An army to fight who? Whomever we need to fight. Whomever stands in our way as we reach for our destiny. Just think of the powers at our disposal. Just consider Tanner. He can bring down a jet airliner without a bomb, missile, or security risk. There's no tracking. There's no preventing. Sudden and complete mechanical failure and the plane drops out of the sky. Do you have any idea what his talent is worth? Terrorists would pay tens of millions. Governments would pay hundreds of millions. Or billions. Especially if that plane were carrying a nuclear weapon, or the President of the United States. And that's just one of many of your graduating class's talents. We just need more of you. A lot more of you. What makes you think anyone will follow you? They will, and they do. Most of them have, at least. It's amazing what you can do to a young mind before the rest of the world contaminates it. It's you older kids, the brainwashed, who are the problem. Like poor, misguided Miss Ridley. I offered her the world and she spat it back in my face. Taylor's a good person, I said, my right eye twitching. That depends entirely on what you mean by good. If by good you mean short-sighted, ungrateful, and small-minded, then you're right. He stood and his expression relaxed. That's enough for today. I'm going to let you stay in one of the guest suites tonight. You'll be much more comfortable there. Unfortunately, for now, you will still be assigned a guard. Don't get me wrong, Michael. I trust you. I really do. I just don't trust the world you come from. Too much of it is still in your head. But we'll work on it. In the meantime, if you have any seditious schemes, remember your mother will pay severely for your mistakes. You shock someone, she'll be shocked twice. You hurt someone, well, you get the picture. It's beautifully ironic. For centuries, the sins of the parents have been answered on the heads of their children. Now the opposite is true. He walked to the door. It's time for you to go. I stood and also walked to the door, followed a few yards back by Nichelle. I'm giving you 48 hours to consider your predicament. I urge you to seriously do so. Lives are at stake here. You've already killed your father. Will you kill your mother, too? His words cut like razor blades. And then there are your friends. If you choose to disregard my offer, Jack and Wade will be the first to go, then Austin, and finally Taylor. It's your call. They're all counting on you to do the right thing. If you don't, they'll disappear one by one. Think carefully now. Are you going to lose a few of them before you change your mind? Or will you do the right thing the first time? As you grow older, Michael, you'll learn an important lesson. That most people spend their entire lives wishing for a second chance to do what they should have done right the first time. Don't be like them, Michael. He smiled at me, placing his hand on my shoulder, which made me feel sick inside. I believe in you. I know you think you're doing the right thing by resisting, but it's because your point of view is skewed. All you have to do is walk across the aisle and see it from our side. And as your reward, I'm offering you everything you've dreamed of. You'll be the head of the Electric Children. You'll have a life a rock star would envy. And you'll have your tailor. He smiled. Yes, I know how you feel about Taylor. And she'll be all yours. Your little friend Austin will be allowed to go home to his mommy and daddy. And your mother will be set free. And someday you'll have the adoration of millions. All around the world, children will want to be you. Remember, history is made by those willing to tear up the last map maker's map. Make history, Michael. You have 2 days to decide whether or not to join us. I dare say that these are the 2 most important days of your life. I know your heart may not entirely be in it at first. I don't expect it to be. There's too much brainwashing in there. I just want to see that you're willing to commit. That's all I ask. And for that simple commitment, I offer you the world. He turned and nodded to the guard. Have a good night, Michael. Let's go, a guard said to me. Michelle and the guards took me to a suite on the 3rd floor. I sat on the bed and the door locked behind me. My head was spinning like a top. My entire world had been turned upside down. For the next 2 days, I was left alone in my room. Under different circumstances, I would have thought I'd died and gone to heaven. The suite had a refrigerator and cabinet that were full of drinks and candies from all around the world. I tried some Japanese candy, choco balls, and high chews,